Chapter 1. Tired, travel-weary, determined Augusta Hastings descended from a grueling ride on the London stage, clutching all she could carry of her possessions in a single valise in one hand, and in the other, a slip of paper that she hoped would lead to her future. She had just given her rumpled skirts a straightening twitch when a man's voice screamed from behind her, "Out of the way, damn you!" Two galloping horses pulling a high-perched phaeton bore down on her so fast she hardly had a moment to think. She leapt to the side just in time to avoid being run over and, splat, heart plummeting, she looked down. As she feared, she'd landed plop in the middle of an ankle-deep, foul-smelling puddle, and the moisture was fast wicking up her best pelisse on its way to her knees.
"Oh, blast your—"
Augusta stopped herself before uttering the vilest curse she could think of, which, being well-born and gently bred, would not have been very vile. Not enough, anyway, to express her utter dismay at being mud-spattered and drenched when it was imperative that she look well-dressed and highly presentable. Not the way to appear when entering on a career in fashion. Before she could gather her wits enough to decide what to do next, a curricle wheeled around the corner nearly as fast as a phaeton had moments earlier. Augusta prepared to shrink even farther back against the brick wall of the coaching inn. This time, though, the much more skilled driver pulled his spanking pair of chestnuts to a halt in front of her. Instead of simply driving on, he touched the handle of his whip to the brim of his hat and said with a chuckle, "Did that rascal Lewiston nearly flatten you?" "He didn't mean it." He was laughing at her. How dare he? She drew herself up, craned her neck, and shielded her eyes from the bright sun behind the gentleman. A man of fashion, clearly, but the expression above the expertly tied neckcloth and many-caped drab driving coat was kind rather than haughty. A smile lifted the corners of his mouth, and he looked her over with a shake of his head.
"Gudgeon," he said.
"Sir, I—"
"Not you, the Marquis."
She pressed her lips together and lifted one eyebrow. After all, she couldn't deny the absurdity of her situation.
"But truly, have you suffered any lasting injury?" he asked.
"As you see, I am unharmed." The gentleman's grey eyes softened, searching hers. This sudden shift caught her unawares, and she found herself struggling against the urge to cry. No one had looked at her that way since the last time she'd seen James over a year ago, resplendent in his dragoon's uniform.
"I see you're travelling, ma'am," the gentleman said, suddenly all crisp politeness, nodding at the valise dangling from her hand. "Have you just arrived on the stage? May I direct you to your lodgings? Or better still, convey you there? Plenty of room for you, and we could squeeze in a chaperone if need be."
A bell of warning clanged in Augusta's mind. She must look like a bedraggled waif, ripe for plucking and ruining, all alone, without a chaperone in sight. And she was exhausted. The constant sounding of the yard of tin at numerous toll gates, the rocking of the stagecoach on rutted roads, and being squeezed in among five other passengers had made it difficult to get so much as a wink of sleep. She said, with a sigh and a note of reluctance,
"I thank you. No, I am travelling alone."
"Ah, you are wary of trusting a stranger. Quite right. But truly, I would be very happy to help you on your way and lend you my paltry protection. My friend has done you a wicked turn."
The spark of amusement leapt back into his eyes.
"He's doing his best to become a top sawyer."
She couldn't help smiling at this and saying, "Those poor horses. But I beg you not to trouble yourself." Then she remembered the paper she held crushed in her hand. She'd read it over at least 100 times, hoping it would reveal a morsel of information that might help her find her way in London, but to no avail. "However, if you would be so kind, you could render me assistance by kindly informing me which way I must go to reach Madame Noel's establishment in Curzon Street."
Ha! He said, his face brightening. I know it well. I've shepherded my sister to that door more times than I can count. It's too far to walk from here, and you'll find a hackney very uncomfortable. You might as well let me take you there. It's the least I can do to atone for my friend's folly.
He reached down with one gloved hand, gazing at her with a look of entreaty.
Well, don't leave me stopped in the middle of Piccadilly, he said with a quick glance over his shoulder,
where several carriages and barrows had stalled behind him, their drivers leaving Augusta in no doubt of their feelings on the matter.
I'm a much better driver than the Marquis, I promise.
Before she had a chance to decline the offer, the gentleman bent nearly in half so he could grasp her hand and held it too firmly for her to get out of his grip. He smoothly lifted her as she took a step onto the board, drawing her up and into the open carriage with a little too much force. As a result, Augusta landed heavily on his lap and nearly lost hold of her valise. Laughter erupted among the curious bystanders, and a little boy pointed at her and said, "Look, Mama, she nearly took a toss."
Mortified, Augusta slid herself to the seat next to the gentleman as far as she could without tumbling down into the road. What must he think of her? She straightened her back and lifted her chin, stowing the leather valise firmly between her feet.
I do beg your pardon, my lord, she said, deciding to over rather than underestimate his rank.
Please do not trouble yourself. As you see, I am unharmed.
A choked laugh escaped her as she recognized his teasing echo of her own words.
I am relieved to hear it, she said.
Now that we have established that we have both survived the hazards of London carriage travel, allow me to introduce myself, the gentleman said, bowing slightly in her direction. George Lanyon, Earl of Bridlington, your servant. Whom do I have the pleasure of escorting? I assume you've come to order your gowns for the season.
Augusta Hastings, my lord, she answered. And I am not here as a customer of Madame Noel, but as an employee. I am a seamstress.
And as a seamstress, she hoped, it was entirely expected that she would travel sans chaperone.
Hastings? Any relation to the Earl, or any of the Grantleys?
A quick flush spread up from her neck.
Of course not. I mean, no, she stammered.
This time, Lord Bridlington's appraising gaze was unmistakable. Thankfully, he was forced to look away in order to manoeuvre his horses through a crush of crossing traffic. That accomplished, he said,
I am sorry. From your voice and your carriage, and under the mud on your ensemble, I assumed you to be a gentlewoman.
I am a gentlewoman, more's the pity, she thought.
A gentlewoman with no desire to acknowledge it. A gentlewoman with ambitions more suited to a bourgeoise and education appropriate to a blue stocking. A gentlewoman well aware that she should not be alone in a smart curricle with a man she does not know. Finally, she said,
You are mistaken, sir. I would be grateful if you would set me down a short distance from Madame Noel's. She has never met me, and I don't want to give her the wrong impression.
Of course, he said.
They progressed in uncomfortable silence for a while. Augusta could hardly bring herself to look around at this hurly-burly city she was hoping to make her home, afraid of accidentally meeting Lord Bridlington's disturbing eyes. He pulled up the horses after they had travelled about a mile.
The address you seek is just there.
Augusta expected he would jump down and help her out of the carriage, but he remained seated. Perhaps the revelation of her assumed station in life had made him think he needn't treat her with further courtesy. So like a member of the ton. She supposed she must accustom herself to different manners in this world she was entering, where, because she laboured for a wage, she would be beneath consideration. Yet Bridlington's expression told a different story. It was no less kind than it had been at the first. Definitely a contradiction. Well, if he couldn't be courteous, at least she could. She stood and put out her hand for him to shake.
I can't thank you enough, Lord Bridlington. You see, I've never been in London before.
And look how we've welcomed you.
He shook his head and took her hand, just as the horses gave a little start of impatience and the carriage rocked. Augusta was thrown off balance and had to brace her other hand on Bridlington's shoulder to avoid, once more, falling onto him. For a moment, they were close enough that she could see the faint lines that led from the corners of his eyes, which deepened as a smile spread across his face. And then he frowned, and his gaze shifted from her eyes to her mouth. Before she could guess what had caused this sudden alteration, he lifted his hand and touched the corner of her lips with his index finger, wiping gently.
There, he said, and held up his glove for inspection.
A dab of mud stained it. Augusta's cheeks flamed.
Oh, sir!
He laughed and helped her stand upright and regain her balance.
I hope you will find the metropolis more to your liking once you've found your footing.
Again, he was laughing at her, but she couldn't help laughing at herself too. Lord Bridlington held on to her until she'd climbed down to the flagway. Augusta drew her hand out of his with a little reluctance. It had felt, for a moment, like an anchor, something solid in her recently tumultuous life. She curtsied without meeting his eyes, then hurried toward the elegantly painted sign up ahead that indicated she had at last arrived to face the future she had chosen for herself. Augusta took a moment to settle her nerves. She refused to admit that she'd been the slightest bit afraid of travelling all that way alone, so far from the places she knew well. She wished she were in better fettle for announcing herself to Madame Noel, but it couldn't be helped. She had been presentable enough for a handsome young nobleman to come to her assistance, and he was handsome, in a quiet way, so different from James's dashing figure. She had no choice but to brazen it out. So she marched up to the door, took hold of the handle, lifted the latch, and pulled, setting a cluster of small bells tinkling.
You should have seen the look on her face. It was pure terror, said a lady's voice. Then another lady added, But you know.
The talking ceased as soon as Augusta came within view. Before her, on a low platform, stood a striking woman of perhaps 20 years, and on the floor next to her, a tall woman in black twilled silk with a tape measure around her neck. Both of them turned to stare at her. The two girls crouching at the feet of the fine lady looked up in unison, eyes widening. The entire tableau multiplied comically in the many long mirrors placed around the room, and Augusta barely suppressed a laugh. The same mirrors reflected a riot of colours and textures of gowns and draped fabrics, trailing ribbons and laces and plumes of feathers, looking for all the world like an enormous, luxurious nest.
Madame Noel, I presume?
Augusta said, recollecting herself and dipping a curtsy.
I am Augusta Hastings.
Instead of giving her the polite welcome she hoped for, the proprietress swept her eyes from Augusta's head to her hem, lips pursed, as if she'd tasted something sour. Her irises darkened, she drew her brows together and flared her nostrils dramatically.
You have no business in here. Pauline, show this girl to the trade entrance. She can start today.
At that, one of the girls, a pert brunette with an uptipped nose, bustled over to Augusta, taking a firm hold of her upper arm to turn her around and head her back out through the door. Before they fully passed through and it closed behind them, Augusta caught the tail end of a conversation between the two women in the shop.
A country bumpkin. Doesn't know any better, my lady, but she's supposed to be good with a needle. What can one do?
Still, she had a bit of an air, the other lady said in a voice cut from the cloth of nobility. Under the dirt, that is.
A musical laugh followed them out the door.
You've landed in it,
Pauline said in a hoarse whisper as she led Augusta down an alley almost too narrow to pass through without brushing against the grimy bricks. They stopped at a low door, which Pauline opened with a bit of effort, and entered a small workroom lit from above by a skylight.
Three seamstresses crouched over work in their laps, sprig muslin, figured silk, and gauzy nets pooling around their feet. The floor was scrupulously clean, unlike the one window, dirty to the point of opacity. A door on one side appeared to lead to the showroom Augusta had just left, and another one bore a crude sign that said, "Stairs." None of the seamstresses looked up when Augusta came in. Pauline cleared her throat.
"Ahem, this is Augusta.
Don't know what she'll do here, but if she's handy with a needle, she'll find plenty of work to keep her busy." Her voice softened as she spoke, perhaps having some sympathy for Augusta's awkward entrance into that world.
"Help? Ha! Divvy up the wages even more, I don't doubt," said a woman with a thick London accent,
wisps of greying hair peeking out of her widow's cap. The other two seamstresses were younger, much younger, one hardly more than a girl. That one looked up with frank curiosity and paused with her needle in midair to stare at her from top to toe. Then she burst out laughing.
"Shh," said Pauline. "Madame will hear you, and then we'll all be for it. Augusta, this is Molly, Bernadette, and Miss Cop."
They nodded in turn as they were introduced. So, these were to be her compatriots. "I should like to take my things to my room. There are lodgings with the position," Augusta said.
"Hoity toity," said the old lady,
the one called Miss Carp.
"Lodgings is a bit rich. A shared room in the attic and a bit of a parlour off it. But no one can take you there till the day's done, so might as well get stuck in with some work, if it ain't beneath you."
She jerked her head toward an empty work table without ceasing her stitching.
"You'll take Prudence's place. She didn't last long."
A silent laugh shook her. Augusta's initial reaction of affront at being addressed in such a crude fashion gave way to curiosity. Why didn't she last long? No one answered. They all cast furtive glances in the direction of the showroom door.
"You can just tuck your things under the table for now," Pauline murmured.
Augusta looked down. The mud had now dried to crispness. She sighed and removed her pelisse, hanging it on a hook Molly pointed out to her. "Where shall I start?" she asked. So it began. This was the life she had chosen, and whatever menial tasks she must perform in order to work her way up to creating her own designs, she would embrace gladly. Augusta was aware that her learned father had been disappointed that she appeared to have more genuine interest in the Mirror of Fashion than in the Iliad. The truth was that she valued both. Every day, she sketched evening gowns and day dresses and riding habits in the little pocketbook she kept in her reticule. And every day, she read something from the well-stocked library at Crossley Grange, her former home. The pocketbook was easy to bring with her in her hasty flight, but she had no room in her one valise for even a single volume from her small collection of books, the ones she'd kept when she moved in with her aunt. Circumstances had forced her to make a decision within hours that she'd been agonising over for months. She knew that all the education in the world would gain her no more than a position as a harassed governess. But her skill with a needle, her eye for fabrics and style, might open a door to something more creative and sustaining, something that could support her in London. So she decided on that course of action. And here she was. Besides, she possessed a magical key to thousands of volumes of all sorts, a veritable treasure trove of books to read to take her away from whatever trials and frustrations she might face in pursuit of her new life. This was her father's subscription to Hookham's, the largest lending library in London. As soon as she settled in, she would go there and select something to read in the quiet hour or so before bed. Choosing one life need not mean abandoning the other altogether, need it? The only thing she wished to put firmly behind her was that respectable future in a detestable marriage, which her aunt seemed to believe the single choice open to a penniless, well-born female. Augusta was determined to prove her wrong.